I think some people try to describe the Internet of Things as something that's going to happen. I really think we live in the Internet of Things.
You're listening to Thinking Out Loud Cities, conversations about the issues impacting and shaping where we live. Some of the work impacting our cities goes beyond the usual topics about urban life. In this episode, Edward Greenspan, President and CEO of the Public Policy Forum, talks with Fenwick McKelvey about the Internet of Things, or what McKelvey calls the Internet as things, as machines, bots, artificial intelligence, algorithms, even demons, that make up the Internet, foundational technologies, all shaping how and where we live. You'll hear Fenwick in this conversation refer to PIPEDIA, P-I-P-E-D-A. This is the Personal Information Protection and Electronic Documents Act in Canada. It's a privacy law for private sector organizations. He also refers to Kathleen Wynne and Rachel Notley. Both are Canadian politicians. Here we go.
Let's start with one of the things that you're working on, which is this, you know, one of the biggest things going, the Internet of Things. And it sounds pretty innocent and pretty broad, and people, I think it appeals to the Internet of Things, but nobody really knows what it means. So why don't we start by telling us, what is the Internet of Things?
The Internet of Things, to me, is a way we can talk about kind of the evolution of the Internet and a reminder of just how present the Internet is in our everyday lives. And so what convinced me to start using the term was thinking about our cell phones, thinking about the ways that we're constantly connected and the ways that our homes are becoming more connected to the Internet. And it really required us to think a bit differently about this idea of connecting cables into computers and to think more broadly about how much there's something, which we'd like to call the Internet of Things, that's woven through our society now. And that includes humans and also machines communicating with each other, and that these devices of all kinds are generating more and more data, and what are the consequences of that data being generated. And the way I'm trying to also define some of my area of research is describe it as I'm looking also at the Internet as things. And so to look at not only what's being connected at the outsides of the Internet, but also trying to look inwards to see what programs, what bots, artificial intelligence, software, and what I call demons are living inside the Internet, and how we can unpack, you know, all the pieces that we assume are working when we plug an Ethernet cable into our laptops.
When we plug in, when people plug in, I think generally they think of the Internet as communications, you know, people communicating with one another one way or another over the Internet. But what we're talking about also with the Internet of Things are kind of inanimate, non-communications technologies that join the Internet. And that's a much broader concept that I don't think is intuitive for people. Is that right?
Yeah, and I think some people try to describe the Internet of Things as something that's going to happen. I really think we live in the Internet of Things. I think it's a term that's more accurate to describe the present moment than the future moment in many ways. It's going to intensify, and there's going to be more things connected. But, you know, you could think of your cell phone and the amount of information your cell phone is sharing every minute to connect to a cell phone tower, the ways it might be sharing data with the platform provider like Google or Apple. I mean, all this is in part a way of saying that, you know, the device or the, you know, the piece of technology in your laptop is also talking on your behalf.
Right, and also how I'm using energy in my house increasingly, and what I'm going to take out of the fridge, and how I use my car, which, you know, increasingly becomes public data, if you will, or data available to authorities.
Well, this is what's coming up, that a device that's not much here in Canada, but might be by the time, you know, you hear me, is the Amazon Alexa, which is one of the ways you can talk. It's a voice-activated assistant. And what it's recording now is raising questions, and it might be involved in a murder case, of whether it heard a murder, and law enforcement agency is actually requesting the data from Amazon to hear what it overheard. And that, I mean, that raises this question of like, can your fridge rat on you about what you're eating? And that's something that, you know, is trying to, I think we're trying to evoke with the Internet of Things now, is that, you know, we're questioning this already with what data is being shared by your cell phone. And that's only going to become more of a question.
To what extent is this an opportunity? And to what extent is there a threat here, and particularly to our privacy?
Certainly when we think of the opportunities, I'm really reminded of something like Pokemon Go, where you can see the kind of reconfiguration of urban space as a result of that. People getting out into parks, hanging out. It's all through a kind of augmented reality app, which depended upon something you'd call Internet of Things like. And
so creating community with that.
Yeah, I mean, there is, you know, there is this creating, I mean, the Internet, I mean, I care and study the Internet because it is this powerful device of connecting people in new and different ways, and in also reminding ourselves that, you know, the strong link in community we've had. You know, the risks in Internet of Things is, I think, one that comes down really about class in many ways, about who can afford to operate in a secure and functional Internet of Things and who's going to be kind of relegated to the budget version of the Internet of Things and some of the consequences to that.
Okay, so you, as you said near the beginning, your work, you investigate machines, bots, artificial intelligence, other algorithms, the expression you use, demons, which is also about. So when we lift the hood on the Internet of Things, what are we seeing there?
I think first off, we're trying to understand what data is being shared without us knowing. And so it comes to these questions about consent. So when you're lifting up the hood, you're looking at all this information that's being shared. And so that's one of the things to take in mind, is that you're trying to understand the ways that your everyday devices are becoming sensors and who's being able to collect and use that data. I think the other thing to me is like lifting that hood, which I love the metaphor. And my family fixes up old cars, and so there's an intuitiveness of technology that I appreciate with the lifting up the hood metaphor. And I think it's why we should keep that metaphor, as much as it's harder and harder to lift up the hood. But I think when we lift up the hood in kind of the Internet as Things, we're looking at questions like the Facebook news feed or YouTube's recommendations. And we're seeing, you know, decisions about what's relevant, what's important, being made by either algorithms following a set procedure, or what we're seeing now on YouTube is deep learning programs that are more responsive, making decisions about what content we should see or not see, which to me really draws on, and what I'm trying to work through is how much that resonates with kind of a broadcasting tradition where we're talking about how media influence what we're seeing exposed to.
Okay, so I think we have two really important ideas in there, at least if we unpack it. You know, one is data and not knowing and not consenting, not understanding what's accumulated about you, whether that might bother you one or not bother one. And the other one is choices, in a sense, editorial choices of what you know, what you're exposed to, that are also being made for you, and that's invisible, isn't it? So let's go down the data one, and then we'll come back to the other one. So I guess I give my consent, not necessarily willingly. I do, you know, tick off some kind of terms and conditions, or maybe I don't even in some cases get to tick it off. I understand because I get served ads that that, you know, relate to choices I've made, et cetera, that, you know, somehow machines know more about me than I actually feel comfortable with them knowing. So am I at fault for consenting? Should I be doing something as a citizen to protect myself?
That's in what we could call the information security world, really is trying to kind of remind us not to make this about guilt or shame, or that you don't know what's going on and that's a problem. I mean, I think that really what, you know, part of the conversation is making more informed choices, more intuitive. The Office of the Privacy Commissioner of Canada really talks about this idea of privacy by design, trying to make sure that programs collect only the information they know and need. And all I'll say is that, you know, trying to find technologies that work for you and you enjoy using and you know what they're doing with your data is really important. And that's when, in some ways, we get into this, you know, this accountability question, is that, you know, we're still trying to find a good language to hold all these different apps we're installing all these different programs, what we're building into our house, and making sure that we can actually observe and monitor and make sure that they are doing what they say they do.
So there's a lot of power and influence, I would guess, against the idea of privacy by design.
Data certainly is something that is being able to be repurposed and becomes a tool for machine learning programs. You know, it's the way that you can capitalize and make profit. It's also really valuable in advertising. Certainly there is this balance, and this is what there's a balance between what we're giving up and what's the impetus for that. And that's, I think, the question of, where do we get into kind of some of the design of these technologies? Who's designing them for what reason?
Well, I think that's an important point, because I think liberal societies have historically been suspicious of the state having too much information on individuals. Now we have commercial enterprises having more information on individuals possibly than the state could have ever contemplated. Should we be worried about that? Should we be moving to regulate that in some form?
So in the United States, data brokers like Dataminr and GeoFIDA have been investigated by the ACLU for their...
So the ACLU is a civil liberties union.
Yeah. And they basically were investigated because they were selling Facebook and Twitter data to law enforcement agencies. We have the same phenomenon taking place in Canada, where we know that programs collecting social media data are being used by government. And so there, I think, becomes this question where it's like twofold, where one, the ways that social media data is being used by who are really, something that we're still trying to understand, particularly in Canada, in my mind, and that this creates questions and challenges. And I think, it's one thing that we're going to see when they're talking about reforming the Canada's laws that govern how the Canadian government interacts and knows about its citizens, which is the Privacy Act. There is some really important work that can be done in the public interest about collecting that data.
And so, okay, but at least there we know there'll be a legislative review of some sort where the public interest will have an opportunity to speak. What about on the commercial side?
Well, there's also a review of PIPEDA, which is the Personal Information Privacy and Electronic Documents Act. Always working on remembering.
Very good.
Let's talk about that too, right? And I think that, this is one of the things that always challenges me is talking about what do we have in terms of jurisdiction in global environments. When you sign into Facebook, certainly you accept a terms of use that says that you're abiding by California law. We know that the Office of Privacy Commissioner has had negotiations with Facebook, and that's led to changes in Facebook. So it's not as though these platforms are exempt. But I think that that's a really contemporary problem that across the board is like, how do you deal with kind of accountability of global institutions?
So earlier you mentioned, I think, Amazon and Netflix and choices that get made for you. And of course, one of your areas of expertise and study is political communications. So how do you see this unfolding, and what questions kind of are exciting your imagination in political communications now, in a world in which some of the choices that you're referring to have been associated with filter bubbles, echo chambers, having some algorithm decide partial visibility for you, I guess.
You can say a few things. First, in terms of the Internet of Things, that what devices are feeding data to political parties potentially is expanding, and we don't know a lot about how political parties collect data about you. They're largely exempted from most of our privacy legislation.
What's the logic of that, by the way?
It's a good question. There's a lot of discussions about whether you should have a code of conduct for political parties about what data they're collecting, and there's a lot of impetus on political campaigns to be able to use data to target people better. Certainly, if also to intimidate their opponents. You have to kind of cut some of the hype from the reality of it. But that's a big question, in that you don't want to interfere with political parties or assume that they're kind of omnipotent.
nonetheless, you're going down the road of political parties and information and choices being made for you and how much, you know, information you have.
I was just going to, you know, say that you can talk about the Internet of Things, going to raise questions about what data potentially might be available to political parties. And, you know, that you can think of as been a historic evolution where you can think about magazine data and demographic information being used by political parties to better target people. And this is the whole micro-targeting or narrow-casting. This has also come up where social media data is becoming more and more valuable, how that's being connected to the campaign and how platforms themselves. And so all I say is one direction of this is, you know, all the kind of activity you're doing in some ways, how your a political app might share information about you becomes really important. The second point is, to me, I'm really interested in this kind of link between a term we use in broadcasting policy, but Canadian cultural policy, this term discoverability, which I'm really trying to name because I think it's significant because it's talking about how content is discovered and also kind of situating that problem in a kind of history of Canadian cultural policy, which is kind of proactive in a certain way. You know, trying to say not only that are we trying to prevent you from seeing bad things, but also trying to encourage you to see important or relevant information, which I don't think is far off from the claims of a company like Google or Facebook. Anyways, discoverability, you know, what we're exposed to, I think is really important in terms of politics, because as much as we're worried about filter bubbles and only seeing information that we kind of self-selected, it really raises more important pressures on platforms like YouTube or Facebook as one of the sites where you can talk about puncturing or breaking a filter bubble and how certainly algorithmic recommendation or what videos it suggests you watch or what content to see next raise questions about what political content you're going to be accidentally exposed to. And that influence is something which, you know, isn't large, it's a slight influence, but I think it's an important one, talking about how these platforms are then going to be some of the ways that we get out of filter bubbles.
So I often get confused by the openness or not of the world that we're living in digitally. And on the one hand, I have available to me more information than ever before, and I can be exposed to more ideas and challenge my ideas. On the other hand, there's algorithms that seem to narrow those choices without me knowing about that. Are you suggesting what you're saying, that there could be programming of algorithms to ensure that I'm not only just reinforced in my prejudices but challenged in my knowledge?
I've been comparing how YouTube and Google recommends videos for Canadian politicians. And I'm really struck when I say Google videos right now for Kathleen Wynne or Rachel Notley, the differences is what I get in terms of Google's video returns and YouTube's videos returns. Google's video returns, it's all from mainstream media news sites about information about her. YouTube video returns are, by and large, very partisan, very politicized, very upset or angry. And it struck me that that becomes a question. As a citizen, when you're searching to know something about a premier, what is the information you should know? What is the question? What is the type of content that becomes the most relevant? And there's a decision made, I think, between how Google is saying, well, this is mainstream sources providing information, or information that might be ranked on, say, salience or recentness. And I'm not saying, I don't know that, and I can't claim to know what that Google algorithm is doing. But what the hint at, I know with the YouTube algorithm, it's about engagement, how much you're connecting, how much there's an emotional response to that. And that raises a really important question that's not about simply like programming it, and this is what I'm always worried about, programming it to recommend more Canadian content. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that there's a decision being made about what's the most relevant information. And I think that there's a way of putting political questions in that. And what are important questions that we should be knowing about politicians? And I think they're already being made on the part of platform providers.
Just before I'll ask, I think, last question here, but, you know, let's just note that Google and YouTube are ultimately owned by the same corporate owner.
Yeah.
But behave differently in that way is interesting. Do we need to have a broad public discussion about this? And how do we have a broad public discussion about something that is so leading edge and so really beyond, I think, the comprehension of many of us?
Yeah, I think that I'm you know, this is something that, you know, I'm following your work. And I really want that conversation to take place in Canada. And I think that this becomes kind of the one way you can think about how it's been successful in the United States is outlets like ProPublica kind of stepping up and running whole pieces on algorithmic bias. And that same software might be used in Canada. I'm trying to find that out right now. And I'm not saying it is, but we don't even know. And I, you know, and there are good journalists really doing that work. And I think that one of the things to do is kind of dispelling, I think, the newness of this technology. I think the really kind of recognizing how everyday this is, how this is the default experience for so many of Canadians. When we're having these conversations and the Canadian government is talking about renewing interest in AI, the Broadcasting Act is on the table, the Telecommunications Act is on the table, Privacy Act, PIPEDA. I mean, one of the things that is really important for this is that a broad-based both conversation, public conversation, what's taking place, and one that can meaningfully translate into legislative outcomes is, I think, vital. Because what I worry about is then, you know, if we rush into this, is that we will really lose sight or make up these policies without having that public engagement.
So even if we're deliberative about this and have the engagement, a lot of people say, well, you can't regulate the internet. The internet's free. And implied in here is some form of regulation of the internet.
Yeah. I'm not – I don't shy away from discussing regulating the internet. I'm not – I think that certainly when I say that there's a distinction between operating nationally and globally, I'm aware when we're talking about internet regulation, that's first and foremost. Because I think what concerns me – I think it's actually a really legitimate concern – is that where we have strong privacy law or we have – you know, whether how good you can say our privacy law, I think that PIPEDA really empowers citizens. And the more I know about it, the more I'm kind of impressed by what it can do. But you also have to think that, you know, those same privacy laws are impacted by regulations that are taking place on a global stage. So one of the things that I think really is important when we have these national conversations is to know that Canada has to be a leader globally on setting out the best privacy law, on the best policies for what the internet's going to be doing, the best regulations on data protection, which I think we have lacking given, you know, what happens to Canadian data when it goes to the United States. And so all I say is that I think that why this conversation is important, not simply for Canadian issues, I think globally. I think that's often sometimes lost when we're having these discussions about national conversations, is we are a country that is involved in setting and settling these questions, and our voice and I think our opinion matters, and I think it has to matter because we risk letting global policy be set and move away or actually in effect undermining some of the rights and protections Canadians enjoy.
So let's end on the on your students, but let's come back to the university and your students. So, you know, this is a great opportunity that you're doing research that's, you know, so engaged with the issues that that we have to address as a society. Your students live this life. They live in this world. You're in a university that's digitally oriented, creative, information oriented type of university. Are they engaged by these issues, or is it sort of like the air and the water to them, just natural elements?
It's a balance. I think that they're concerned about issues that I think are really front and center, like growing precarity, some of the consequences of AI, the gig economy. I mean, all those things are stuff they're living. They're also, I think, deeply enmeshed in the way that the internet and information production has changed. And so a lot of when we're talking about the future of journalism, what we sometimes miss is just how much public relations and the way that content, lots of content is being created on the web for very different reasons and for very different motivations. And so they're so enmeshed in that. And sometimes that you realize that I'm just always humbled because they're living it, they're working, they're doing it, and they're trying to understand that world. I think the other challenge at times is we also, you know, can make this technology so simple and intuitive. And it's about also encouraging and working with them to unpack and question and understand how this technology works. And so it's always this balance because I always say that, like, I come to the class and they are already media producers and I'm just trying to help them reflect on their own practices. And I think in one of the ways that I'm also learning to do that is realizing that my own contingent upbringing that had to deal with broken computers that didn't work well is a good way of helping them just also reflect on some of the technologies they take for granted.
Fascinating discussion. Thank you very much, Fenwick.
My pleasure.
This podcast was created and produced by the Thinking Out Loud team at Concordia University's Studio C. The Thinking Out Loud Cities episodes are part of a collaboration between Concordia University and the Public Policy Forum. Thanks to our host, Edward Greenspan, the Public Policy Forum, and our guests. Listen to other TOL Cities episodes or check out the TOL 2067 series, all about research and the future. Can we speculate on what's coming next? What will 2067 look like? Big ideas, provocative conversation. Listen in at concordia.ca/TOL or wherever you get your podcasts.